Good morning and welcome to The Way I See It. My name is Vanessa Coleman. Now today, by way of a change, I thought I'd read you a little bit from my book, An Accidental Madam. So I'm starting on halfway through the book, chapter 11, and the heading is Henley-on-Thames, Summer 1981. The sign above the shop read Coleman's Fruiterers and Greengrocers. It was situated in a prime location, right opposite Boots the Chemist, in Bell Street, Henley-on-Thames. We'd bought the leasehold business as a going concern for £25,000. Unfortunately, we'd had to have a bridging loan to purchase the business, as we were still waiting for the shop in West Drayton to sell and to be paid out from the proceeds of the house sale. But I thought it was well worth the risk. The first time I set my eyes on the premises, I remarked to Peter that it would be an ideal place to have a coffee shop. "Forget it," he said adamantly. "It's a greengrocer's and it's going to stay a greengrocer's." With Dad's help and a couple of part-time staff, I continued to run the business at West Drayton. In the meantime, Peter focused all his attention on the Henley shop. Every day, Elizabeth and I commuted the 25 miles between the two shops. While I was working, she was looked after by Mum, apart from the few hours a week she spent at nursery school. It was about this time that we discovered she suffered from petit mal, a form of epilepsy. These were absent spells that only lasted seconds, but unfortunately it affected her learning, and needless to say, it was extremely worrying. Meanwhile, Mark had stayed on at the flat above the shop at West Drayton to finish his schooling. Since his father's death, he had taken up weightlifting at school. To my mind, he was channeling all his hurt and anger into this sport, and by the time he was 15, he'd become the British under-18 weightlifting champion. Eventually, I received £15,000 from Bill's estate from the sale of the house. And shortly after this, the shop sold as well, which meant we could pay off the bridging loan. After everything I'd been through, I felt I needed a break and decided to treat myself to a week at Champneys Health Farm in Tring, Hertfordshire. When I arrived there, the car park was overflowing with expensive top-of-the-range vehicles, and I felt quite intimidated. My car was not quite a banger, but getting on that way, so I parked it as far away from the entrance as I possibly could. I can't recall the building very well, but I do remember feeling at ease as soon as I was inside. I liked the fact that once we were parted from our material possessions and dressed in identical white robes, we all appeared equal. It certainly was a great social leveller. The strange thing was that most people were there to lose weight, and yet the main topic of conversation always seemed to be about food. On the first evening at dinner, I found myself sat next to Azee, a large black man. He was middle-aged and practically bald, and when he laughed, he roared, displaying a perfect set of dazzling white teeth. Instinctively, I knew that he was used to being in control, and it wasn't long before I was drawn in by his magnetic personality. He told me that he suffered from high blood pressure and had been ordered by his doctor to lose some weight. By the end of the evening, I had learnt that he was a high court judge from Lagos in Nigeria. During that week, we became very friendly and always made a point of sitting next to each other at mealtimes. He was always the centre of attention, and I could see he loved nothing more than regaling the guests with his tall stories. He was a wonderful raconteur, and I found him fascinating. After a few days, it became obvious that we were very attracted to each other, and the night before I was due to leave, he invited me to spend the night with him. I knew what I was doing was wrong, and I should have turned him down, but unfortunately, the temptation was too strong. His room was situated discreetly at the end of the garden wing, which was linked to the main house where I was staying. As far as I was aware, no one saw me enter his room that night. The inevitable happened, and although he was nearly 20 years older than me, he had great stamina. He was also an exciting and considerate lover. In fact, I don't recall getting much sleep that night. Before I left Champneys, he invited me to Lagos, and as if to entice me, he showed me photographs of the fabulous country club he belonged to, with its enormous swimming pool and lush grounds. It was evident he enjoyed a very affluent lifestyle, but I had to decline his offer. I told him that it was out of the question, as I had to build up our new business in Henley. And when he told me that he had to be driven round in a bulletproof Rolls-Royce, I knew that I'd made the right decision. Azee was a hanging judge, and consequently he was constantly in danger. What an awesome responsibility, I thought, to have the power in one's hands to decide whether someone lives or dies. I knew then that I would never visit him in Lagos. I'd arrived as a brunette and a week later left as a blonde and half a stone lighter. Being at Champneys had also allowed me plenty of time to think about my relationship. I realised that if it hadn't been for the business, I doubt very much that I would have chosen to be with Peter. He was a good man and I knew he really loved me, but unfortunately he didn't light my fire. I was trapped, but there was no way I could afford to leave him. As my father had said, "You've made your bed and now you must lie on it." In comparison to the shop in Henley, the flat above was huge. This was because it was also over the little handbag shop next door to us. It had three large reception rooms on the first floor and a galley kitchen, with three bedrooms and the bathroom on the top floor. I think it was probably a Victorian building with its very high ceilings and huge fireplaces. Unfortunately, there was no central heating in the flat, just a gas fire in the lounge and dining room. In the lounge, there were large bay windows that looked over to Boots and the other shops in Bell Street. My first encounter with a Henley resident happened when I parked outside the shop to offload some stock. As Bell Street was a narrow one-way street, I bumped the car about a foot onto the pavement so as not to stop the flow of traffic. "You won't get away with doing things like that in this town, my dear," said an officious-looking grey-haired woman. Mary was a retired councillor who would become not just a good customer, but a very good friend as well. "They'll either make you or break you in Henley," she said. "In that case, we'll definitely have to try and make it," I replied with a grin. Henley-on-Thames had more than its fair share of lords and ladies, and Peter and I did everything we possibly could to look after our customers. Nothing was too much trouble. It was very much a case of "yes, lady so-and-so," and "no, lady so-and-so." We would literally jump through hoops to keep them happy. The area was full of famous people, many of whom had accounts at our shop. The most notable amongst these was George Harrison, the ex-Beatle, and his wife Olivia. They lived just a 10-minute walk away in Friar Park. Unfortunately, I never got to meet George. The orders were usually collected by one of his brothers, either Pete or Harry. They were an affable pair of Liverpudlians, and although they didn't particularly look like George, they certainly sounded like him. We couldn't have been in Henley much more than 6 months, when we were to find out that Waitrose, which was also in Bell Street, was having a massive refurbishment. As well as doubling the size of the grocery section of the store, it was also going to be self-service. "Oh no, not again," I cried to Peter. "I can't believe our luck." Things were to get even worse. Another greengrocer's opened up in the next street. History was repeating itself. We knew we had to come up with something spectacular or we would not survive. Without capital, there was not a lot we could do, but eventually we decided to have a delicatessen section, keeping just the fruit side of the original business. After a request from one of our customers, we started making fresh sandwiches to order. Since Mark was now living with us and didn't have a job, he volunteered to start a delivery round to the local shops and offices. This proved to be extremely successful. I joined the health club at the Ramada in Reading, not particularly for the gym, more for the swimming pool. I especially liked to swim. I tried to get there at least a couple of times a week after work. It was on one of those occasions that I met a woman who introduced me to Herbalife, a multi-level marketing business from the States. In fact, I was probably one of the first people in this country who joined. I figured that not only would I lose weight on the products, but I would be earning extra cash that we so desperately needed. After a month or so, a Canadian girl answered my advert for Herbalife. This would turn out to be a life-changing meeting. Belinda was in her early 20s. She was a larger-than-life character in every way. She was a big girl with a big personality to match, which made her the perfect candidate for this health and weight loss business opportunity. Immediately, she could see the potential, and within half an hour of meeting, she had signed up. I gave her the Herbalife badge to wear with the words, "Lose weight now, ask me how," inscribed on it. She then asked if I knew anywhere in Henley where we could go for a good cup of coffee. I wasn't sure. The only thing I could think of was to try one of the quaint tea shops near the river. We were told that they only served afternoon tea that came with a plate of sandwiches and cake. As I said to Belinda, we could hardly sit there with our Herbalife badges on, munching away on sandwiches and cake. "Fancy no decent coffee shop in a place like Henley," Belinda sighed as we took our seats in the Wimpy Bar. "Why don't you open one yourself? There's definitely a gap in the market." It sounded a good idea, but I couldn't help wondering why no one else had thought of it before. That night, I had to convince Peter that we should go all out for a coffee shop. At first, he was apprehensive and pointed out that we didn't have any money to do this. Plus, of course, we would have to get planning permission. However, in the end, he conceded and admitted that it was a case of do or die. I didn't let the grass grow under my feet. The very next day, I made an appointment to see John, our assistant bank manager, with a view to securing a loan. He was a regular customer and was well aware of our situation. He'd always said if we needed any help to go and see him. I told him about my experience with Belinda the day before, and although he liked the concept, he thought our premises, which were 30 feet long but only 9'6" wide, weren't big enough. I, on the other hand, was adamant that it would work. He then asked me for my first year's projections. $65,000 in the first year, I said confidently, with a 60-65% profit margin. When he asked me how I'd arrived at that figure, I naively replied, "I just know." He gave me a wry smile. I think he probably thought I was bonkers. He asked what collateral we had to secure the loan. I told him it would have to be the lease on my parents' maisonette that Peter owned in West Drayton. "I'm afraid we'll have to have a written agreement from them," he said firmly. He told us that if for any reason we did not honour the loan of £10,000, then the bank would look to sell the property and get their money back that way. It was a daunting situation. The following evening, Peter and I went to see Mum and Dad. We explained our predicament, that basically if we didn't reinvent the business for which we required capital, we would go under and lose everything, including the roof over our head. Naturally, they were apprehensive and very worried about their own security, but in the end they relented and signed on the dotted. Our next move was to get permission from the landlord. The freehold of the property was owned by one of the colleges at Oxford University, and when we put forward our plans, they were quite happy for us to go ahead. Apparently, 8 Bell Street had been a greengrocer's for at least 50 years, and they commented that it was well overdue a makeover. What I didn't realise at the time was that any improvements we made would put up the value of the property and eventually incur an increase in the rent. Following this, we put in for planning permission with the local authority, and our plans were duly displayed in the shop window. A day or two later, I overheard a couple of people discussing the matter outside the shop. "It's not big enough for a coffee shop," one said. "No, it'll never work," said the other. My back went up. "Oh, yes, it will," I thought. "Just wait and see. I'll prove you all wrong." I hope you enjoyed that reading, and should you want to buy my book, it is now available in printed form as well as an ebook on Amazon. So all it leaves me to do now is to say good day, have a great day, until we next meet. Thanks. Bye for now.